Another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 26th issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As always, thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: securities regulators are investigating the trading of situational awareness. The AI-focused hedge fund that suffered billions of dollars in losses before selling the bulk of its portfolio in July. Major U.S. stock indexes rose, with the S&P 500 and Dow Industrials both gaining 0.3% and the NASDAQ advancing 0.7%. A key executive overseeing OpenAI's data center build-out, Chris Malone, left the company last week, joining a wave of leadership departures ahead of a planned public offering. The U.S. initial public offering market, already on track for a record year, is expected to swell further, with flotations expected after Labor Day that include Aura, Switch, and SB Energy. United Airlines is readying its biggest international expansion, adding routes to cement its lead over rivals and overtake Delta as the most profitable U.S. carrier. California Attorney General Rob Bonta expressed confidence that the lawsuit he and 11 other state attorneys general filed to block Paramount's merger with Warner Brothers Discovery will succeed in court. Lego reported record sales for the first half of the year as it launched hundreds of new products, with homegrown and licensed themes proving popular. Shares of Intuit fell 10% in after-hours trading Tuesday, after the company forecasts that revenue would grow 9% to 10% for fiscal 2027, slowing from 14% last year. Bank of Nova Scotia's earnings rose in the latest quarter, getting a big boost from its global wealth management and global banking and markets operations. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. Canada plans to impose tariffs of up to 50% on roughly 700 American products in retaliation for new U.S. levies, escalating tensions between two of the world's most closely integrated economies. Trump threatened to change the name of Lake Ontario to Lake America in a further escalation of tensions. CIA Director John Ratcliffe made a surprise visit to Moscow on Tuesday, U.S. officials said, his first publicly known trip to the Russian capital. Senator Darlene Graham won South Carolina's Republican Senate primary runoff, beating a conservative challenger and showing the enduring power of Trump's endorsement in GOP politics. Trump submitted a landmark nuclear accord with Saudi Arabia to Congress for review, but hasn't dropped his last-minute condition that the kingdom normalize relations with Israel. Deloitte agreed to pay nearly $21.5 million to settle allegations that it defrauded the federal government by continuing to consider diversity when making hiring, promotion, and staffing decisions. New claims are emerging about health risks residents of East Palestine, Ohio, faced and may still face after a Norfolk Southern train carrying hazardous chemicals derailed in 2023 and some of the freight was burned. An oil tanker was struck and disabled near the Strait of Hormuz, the UK Maritime Trade Operations said, as new diplomatic efforts failed to mitigate a U.S.-Iran standoff. Two unvaccinated people in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, died after contracting measles, the first U.S. deaths from the viral disease reported this year. Extreme heat and droughts in Europe are severely damaging harvest and likely will result in crop failures, the European Commission's Crop Monitoring Survey said. The Louisiana National Guard is ending its 8-month deployment patrolling New Orleans, and troops will be withdrawn from the city by the end of the month. Died Dolly Parton, 80, star singer, songwriter. The picture on today's front page shows Dolly Parton with a guitar in her hand performing. And that headline, Dolly Parton, Queen of Country Music, Dies at 80. The caption, always. Dolly Parton rose from a hardscrabble Tennessee childhood to become a prolific songwriter, multi-platinum recording artist, Hollywood actress, philanthropist, and head of her own entertainment empire. The article, Country Singer Became a Beloved Icon. In addition to being a musical artist and actress, Parton was a philanthropist. By Alan Light. One night in 1973, Dolly Parton had a song on her mind. She was thinking about a bank teller who had been flirting with her spouse. She got this terrible crush on my husband, Parton told NPR in 2008. And he just loved going to the bank because she paid him so much attention. Needing a name for this tall, red-headed temptress, she thought of another flame-haired girl, an 8-year-old who approached her for an autograph after a taping of the Porter Wagner Show, the TV series on which she was featured. That child's name was Jolene. Parton died Tuesday at age 80 in Nashville, Tennessee, according to her family. The cause of death wasn't released. In May, she canceled a Las Vegas residency because of health issues. When the song Jolene was finished, legend had it, Parton wasn't done working. The same evening, she composed another that she would present to Wagner on her way of letting him know that she would be leaving the show to concentrate on her solo career. She called this one, I Will Always Love You. Both songs became classics. Jolene was a number one country hit and has been covered dozens of times over the years by artists from Olivia Newton-John to the White Stripes to Lil Nas X. I Will Always Love You was recorded by Whitney Houston for the 1992 film The Bodyguard, and that version is the best-selling single of all time by a female solo artist. Parton remains one of the most prolific songwriters who ever lived. By her estimation, she wrote more than 3,000 songs, more than 1,000 of which were recorded and released. The most I've ever written in a day and a night is 20 songs, she once said, and out of those 20 songs, 15 have been recorded. Parton put out more than 50 studio albums, resulting in 27 gold and platinum albums, and total sales over 100 million worldwide, including 113 charting singles. As an actress, she starred in films including 9 to 5, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, and Steel Magnolias. In addition to 11 Grammy Awards out of 50 nominations, she received nominations from the Academy, Tony, and Emmy Awards. In 1999, she was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame, in 2001, into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and in 2005, she received the National Medal of Arts. Her entertainment empire, worth more than $500 million, included the Dollywood theme park in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, which draws more than 2 million visitors annually. Parton's philanthropic efforts were legendary. To honor her father, Robert Lee Parton, who never learned to read and write, she started the Imagination Library, which donated more than 200 million books to children around the world. In 2020, she contributed $1 million to Vanderbilt University for virus research, which helped kickstart Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine. Everything I do, she told The Guardian in 2023, whether it's my personality, how I conduct myself and business, or whatever, if I do it my way, according to what I understand and believe, there's a strength in that. Dolly Rebecca Parton was born January 19, 1946, in a two-room cabin in Pittman Center, Tennessee. She was the fourth of her sharecropper parents' 12 children. She wrote her first songs at age 5, and when she was 10, she became a regular on Knoxville's The Cass Walker Farm and Home Show. Parton cut her first single, Puppy Love, which she co-wrote in 1959, and made an appearance on the Grand Ole Opry before returning home to finish high school, becoming the first in her family to graduate. The next day, she took a bus to Nashville. Fred Foster, founder of Monument Records and Combine Publishing, took notice of Parton and released a series of pop singles, even booking her on American Bandstand. When this direction didn't pan out, Parton wasn't deterred. In her 2023 book, Behind the Scenes, she wrote that she remembered thinking, I've got the talent if somebody hangs with me long enough. She became a cultural icon and grew to be known for her curvaceous figure and outrageous style, at least as much as for her music. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Continuing with articles from the front page. U.S. squeezes Tehran, but avoids targeting Iran's lifeline, China. Treasury structured the whole thing to give China room to adjust quietly. By Rory Jones and John Emont. The U.S. launched what it described as an unprecedented campaign to cripple Iran's economy by cutting off every remaining lifeline sustaining the country. Yet, unmentioned in Scott Bessent's speech announcing Operation Economic Outcast was the country that has enabled Iran to withstand years of U.S. pressure, China. The announcement Monday by the U.S. Treasury Secretary, which included penalties against companies enabling Iran, but fell short of more forceful sanctions on China, illustrates the challenge for Washington in squeezing Tehran economically. Iran relies on China to buy most of its oil. Beijing has, in turn, established an elaborate system to move the sale proceeds around the world without triggering U.S. sanctions. But Washington so far has proven reluctant to seriously confront Beijing over its support for the U.S. enemy. The rhetoric was ferocious, but the punch less so, said Daniel Fried, a former U.S. diplomat now at the Atlantic Council, a think tank. Dealing a crippling blow to Iran's economy would probably require taking on big Chinese firms and banks. As part of its new effort to end the war with Iran, the U.S. sanctioned more than 60 entities, including Chinese firms that enable Iran to procure nuclear and missile technology, earn revenue from oil, and carry out cyber operations. The latest U.S. initiative builds on more than 1,000 sanctions the Trump administration has placed on Iran since returning to power last year. The effort, alongside military operations and a naval blockade of Iranian ports, has damaged Iran's economy, collapsing its currency. But the U.S. has failed to change Tehran's aggressive military posture in the Middle East or deter it from seeking nuclear weapons. Bessent said President Trump is making phone calls to world leaders to request they stop doing business with Iran and warned the U.S. would soon impose sanctions on an unnamed financial institution for evasion. Sanctions generally aim to cut off targets from the U.S. financial system, turning them into economic pariahs and threatening companies that dare to trade with them. The Treasury also said Monday it would levy future penalties on countries and entities that do business with Iran in five sectors: digital assets, technology, gold, aviation, and shipping. Treasury structured the whole thing to give China room to adjust quietly, said Carrie Bischoff, a former Treasury official. The framing means China can change behavior without its banks being targeted, she said. Whether Chinese banks and refineries judge Bessent's threats credible will be crucial. Canada hits back at Trump with new tariffs. Up to 50% levies target $20 billion of American products in strategic areas. By Paul Vieira, Ottawa. Canada plans to impose tariffs of up to 50% on about 700 American products in retaliation for new U.S. levies, Canadian officials said Tuesday, escalating tensions between two of the world's most closely integrated economies. The Canadian tariffs were designed to protect domestic companies hit by a fresh set of hefty U.S. tariffs or to sting President Trump and the GOP as fellow Republicans head into a difficult midterm election in November, Canadian officials said. The new levies would go into effect September 8th, affecting about $20 billion of goods, or about 7% of the total U.S. imports. Analysts noted that the tariffs targeted products made in states with hotly contested congressional elections, like processed cheese from Wisconsin, seafood from Maine, and washers and dryers from Kentucky, where General Electric has a major operation. Most of the tariffs are between 15% and 50%. U.S. steel and aluminum were already subject to a 25% tariff, but that will now double to 50%, officials said. We are being wise and strategic, Industry Minister Melanie Joly said. Canada imposed the tariffs after the U.S. slapped new import duties on $20 billion of Canadian goods over the weekend after trade talks collapsed, targeting hockey sticks, cement, paper, chemicals, and a host of other products. In a statement, the White House said that Canada has been ripping off the U.S. for decades, and President Trump is done letting them get away with it. The statement said U.S. officials offered Canada the most preferential market access of any country globally, with deep cuts to tariffs on Canadian steel, aluminum, automobiles, and lumber. Canada chose unreasonable demands, walkbacks, and flat-out rejection, the White House said. World's craziest market turns into a freight ride. The slow-motion collapse in South Korea's KOSPI index erased $2.5 trillion in market value, burning small-time investors. By Ji Young Sung, Soo Young Ri, and Jack Pitcher, Seoul. South Korea had the world's hottest stock market for most of the past year, powered by the artificial intelligence boom. Then it crashed. Yoon Jae-yi, a 30-year-old English teacher, lost $19,000. She has since cut her living expenses, fewer taxi rides, less travel. Skipping meals, she tells herself, doubles as a diet. South Korea, which introduced Squid Game and K-pop, now hosts the world's craziest stock market, showcasing a stomach-churning volatility not seen in major markets in years. The benchmark KOSPI index more than tripled in value, driven by faith in the AI boom. Two South Korean companies, memory chip maker Samsung Electronics and SK Hynix, soared to trillion-dollar valuations and became the twin forces pushing record market gains. Then the KOSPI plummeted around 40% over 6 weeks in June and July, burning hundreds of thousands of investors, a sober warning to those betting big on the AI industry. The roller coaster ride has continued. The KOSPI has since rebounded about 20% from its low. The volatility is just too severe. This isn't sound investing. It's a gambling table, a casino, said a 68-year-old who heads the Korea Stockholders Alliance, a group representing the country's roughly 14 million individual investors. As flock cameras surge, bipartisan anger rises. Flock has 120,000 cameras operating in 49 states. By Chris Maher, Atlanta. The fight against flock safety is getting louder and more sophisticated. even as the company's AI-enabled cameras continue to spread across the U.S. Last week, here in Atlanta, the license plate reader company barred the media from its annual conference with law enforcement agencies. But that didn't deter Ben Jordan, a cybersecurity researcher who has racked up millions of views on YouTube criticizing the company. He parked a gray van loaded with electronics nearby, pointed an antenna at the hotel, and listened in. "I'm going to do whatever I can, whatever the law allows me to do, to gather as much information as possible," he said. "I do want to hear what they're saying to the police." Flock has 120,000 cameras in 49 states that capture 20 billion license plates a month, along with dents, bumper stickers, and other identifying features. The company has said it is giving police a powerful tool to catch criminals. But the same bipartisan public anger that has risen up from towns and cities to stall data centers is now aimed at its spreading camera network. Leaving the front page, CIA director makes surprise trip to Russia. Kremlin might be preparing for a possible Ukraine military mobilization. CIA Director John Ratcliffe spent about 4 hours in Moscow on Tuesday. Agency declines to comment on Ratcliffe's first publicly known Moscow visit. By Alexander Ward and Thomas Grove, Washington. Central Intelligence Agency Director John Ratcliffe made a surprise trip to Moscow on Tuesday, U.S. officials said, his first publicly known visit to the Russian capital. It came as the U.S. struggles to end Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the Iran war, but the reason for the visit wasn't immediately clear. The U.S. has collected intelligence showing Russia's early preparations for a possible military mobilization in Ukraine and plans for testing the North Atlantic Treaty Organization's resolve, the Wall Street Journal has reported. Analysts said Ratcliffe could meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin to deliver a warning. It could be to say, "We know what you are thinking about doing, and you better not," said Beth Sanner, a former U.S. Deputy Director of National Intelligence for Mission Integration. It could also be about the Iran ceasefire and putting someone else in the discussion, she said. Adding Ratcliffe might also touch upon the Kremlin's support for Iran following a new U.S. sanctions campaign against the regime. Trump sends nuclear deal with Saudi Arabia to Congress by Michael R. Gordon and Robbie Gramer. President Trump has submitted a landmark nuclear accord with Saudi Arabia to Congress for review, but hasn't dropped his last-minute condition that the kingdom normalize relations with Israel, an administration official said. The move is expected to trigger months of intensive debate among lawmakers about how to boost the American nuclear industry while curbing the spread of weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East. When Trump officials announced the 30-year accord last month, they said then that it would give U.S. companies a central role in developing Saudi Arabia's nuclear infrastructure while excluding foreign competition. But the deal has proved to be controversial because it would potentially open the door for uranium enrichment to take place on Saudi territory. Under U.S. law, the agreement must be submitted to Congress for review. But the deal, which was transmitted to lawmakers Monday, will be difficult for lawmakers to block. Doing so would require a joint resolution and a two-thirds majority vote to override a potential presidential veto. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, the metals lobby's big steal. Americans now pay 75% more for aluminum than the rest of the world, and 64% more for steel. The U.S.-Canada trade war escalated again Tuesday as Prime Minister Mark Carney announced new tariffs on some $20 billion in U.S. goods. That includes doubling Canada's tariff rate on U.S. steel and aluminum to 50% to match Mr. Trump's. And the political backstory here is worth more attention. Multiple press reports say that an agreement to avert a 50% U.S. tariff on $20 billion in Canadian goods broke down last week, in part because of objections by the U.S. steel and aluminum lobbies. The mooted deal would have reduced those tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum to 25% from 50%. Call it a case study in how a narrow special interest calls the tune for the rest of the American economy. The current U.S. tariffs on metals date to Mr. Trump's first term, originally set at 25% for steel and 10% for aluminum in the name of national security. But his first administration exempted Canada and Mexico to mitigate the damage to downstream U.S. users in manufacturing and construction. Soon after taking office for a second time, Mr. Trump removed these exemptions, later raising the tariffs to 50%. After U.S. manufacturers that use steel and aluminum complained that the taxes made them less globally competitive, he imposed a 25% tariff on so-called derivative imports that contain the metals. Who knew stainless steel pots were a national security threat? These sky-high border taxes have caused U.S. aluminum and steel prices to soar. The price premium for U.S. aluminum over the global benchmark has increased fivefold since Mr. Trump took office a second time. Americans are now paying roughly 75% more for aluminum than the rest of the world. Steel prices in the U.S. are also about 64% higher than in Northern Europe. One reason these differentials are larger than 50% is because the metal tariffs are stacked on top of other tariffs on China, which is the world's largest producer of steel and aluminum. The metal tariffs, including copper, have raised some $46.9 billion in revenue for the government during the current fiscal year through June, plus $21.8 billion in 2025. That's good for politicians, but a nearly $70 billion tax on Americans. The higher prices have also been great for the share prices of aluminum and steel producers. Nucor's stock is up 66% over the last year, Steel Dynamics 74%, Century Aluminum 98%, and ArcelorMittal 117%. That's nice for their investors, but U.S. businesses that use steel and aluminum and their customers are paying tens of billions of dollars more as a result. Whether they know it or not, they're drinking it in every can of soda. Protectionists say jobs in fabricated and primary metal manufacturing have increased 22,100 since Mr. Trump took office. But overall, U.S. employment in manufacturing has declined 62,000. The metals tariffs help a few favored companies in two industries at the expense of everyone else. This is how tariffs work in practice, and once in place, they are difficult to repeal as lobbies form to defend them. By the way, President Trump admitted Monday that the U.S. needs aluminum from Canada, contrary to his social media posts the same day. This country desperately needs aluminum, Mr. Trump said during a telephone rally for a GOP candidate in Oklahoma. We don't have it. We get it all from Canada for the most part, and we need it badly. Thanks to his latest tariffs, we'll now be paying much more for it after Mr. Carney's decision to double Canada's tariffs on U.S. steel and aluminum. This may cause Mr. Trump to dig in further on his trade war. But it will also impose a cost on the industry groups egging on his protectionism and maybe teach them that their tariff border wall isn't free. Trump, mail ballots, and the Supreme Court. The justices withhold judgment on his USPS push as November 3rd nears. Mail ballots for the midterms are scheduled to start going out to voters as soon as next week, 60 days before the November 3rd election. The summer is slipping away as the judiciary considers President Trump's effort to push the U.S. Postal Service into ballot oversight. The Supreme Court on Monday lifted a hold on this plan, but it could be back before the justices soon. Mr. Trump signed an order in March telling the USPS to draw up rules to standardize ballot envelopes, as well as to keep a mail-in and absentee participation list for each state. The USPS shall not transmit mail-in or absentee ballots from any individual unless those individuals have been enrolled, Mr. Trump's order said. A group of states sued and obtained an injunction from a federal judge. That legal pause was premature, according to the justices. Mr. Trump's action orders the Postal Service to initiate the process of proposing a rule, says the unsigned opinion in Trump versus California. But that directive imposes no legal requirements on the states, or for that matter, on anyone outside the executive branch. The job of judges isn't to intervene in the executive branch's internal monologue. Yet the court emphasizes it takes no position on the lawfulness of whatever concrete changes might result from Mr. Trump's order. On that score, time will tell. As it happens, the USPS on Friday published its final rule, effective immediately, though it's currently blocked by a second injunction issued by the same judge in a separate case. The Trump administration also wants that one dissolved, though a challenge to the final rule will arrive before long. It's hard to imagine Mr. Trump's plan could take effect before November, and the timing is getting worse. The administration first asked the justices for help on July 27th. What took so long? The main opinion is 10 pages. A dissent by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, joined by Justice Elena Kagan, is 4 pages and says the decision merely postpones the case. Then comes Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson with a separate 23-page dissent, diving into the merits. The president does not have any legal authority to require that elections be conducted in accordance with his preferences, she says, or to withhold delivery of mail-in ballots that are not formatted consistent with the president's wishes. If she resisted the urge to write this and deploy the word cuffcask, meaningless, could the court have ruled sooner? On the point about speculative harms, the USPS rule sounds more modest than the order from Mr. Trump. The voter list will be based entirely on data from the states, and the post office will not change the content or even cross-check it against other sources. The files will be a manifest meant to assist election officials and law enforcement to understand who may have been mailed a ballot. The rule says the process applies only to outbound ballots, not voted ones being returned. The USPS resists the idea that any ballots are deemed non-mailable, saying they simply will need special handling akin to other categories. For example, cremated human and animal remains must be transported through specific types of USPS-provided boxes. The courts will now chew over those arguments, and the justices might too. We trust they'll want to protect the authority of the states to control their elections. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the opinion pages, The Socialism We Already Have. Sorry, youngsters, asks Scott Bessent. We've already run out of other people's money. By Holman W. Jenkins, Jr. This century's socialist wave starts at a big disadvantage. It arrives as the socialism we already have runs out of that famous quantity, other people's money. Indeed, it's a wonder Mandani's voters in New York City aren't raging against our existing socialism, which favors the old over the young, the homeowner over the renter, the high-income healthcare consumer against those starting out. A fantastic folly is increasingly seen everywhere. Property tax breaks for homeowners over 65. Voila, yet another way of shifting the fiscal burden of government to the young, while putting housing availability even more out of reach for them and their families. Illustrated here is the fundamental flaw in the Marxian slogan, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. Who decides? Our solution, voters, is only slightly better than handing over the power to a bureaucratic dictatorship. After all, I vote, and I'm pretty sure my abilities are quite skimpy, whereas my needs are unlimited. Young socialists might want to get their heads around something else. International politics doesn't allow countries to opt out of the competition for wealth and technology. In the last century, socialism was a nice word for seizing the output of farmers, leaving them to starve, to build state industry and military production in places like Russia and China. In rich societies, as we've seen, It became a scheme for redistributing resources from young to old on terms that now point to fiscal disaster because of faulty mortality and fertility assumptions. Witness the frantic efforts this week of Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent to keep the government funded amid fears of a deadly mix of rising interest rates and rising inflation. Young people want more of this? An American baby born today owes $376,000 in federal debt and unfunded entitlement liabilities, assuming the burden is evenly distributed. Of course it isn't. We oldsters plan on checking out before the bill comes due. Let me be the thousandth person to notice that the New York socialism of Mayor Zoran Mandani seems to appeal especially to privileged young people still supported in adulthood by their parents. Meanwhile, perhaps the most insidious piece of regressive socialism is the $240 billion annual tax break for employer-provided health insurance, benefiting those in the highest tax brackets, inflating cost for everyone else. Luigi Mangione has a following among today's young socialists for murdering a health insurance executive. A PBS NewsHour fool posed to an intellectually corrupt former insurance executive the proposition that insurers themselves engage in a kind of violence when denying claims. Such posturing contributes nothing. The amount of health care people want to consume must still be reconciled with their willingness to pay. It must be reconciled with the desire of medical professionals not to work for free. Bernie Sanders has an answer: make billionaires pay. Unfortunately, the wealth of billionaires consists of property rights, the value of which disappears if confiscated. The Scandinavian society's young socialist idealized actually protect private wealth. Their middle-class taxpayers pay taxes willingly because the benefits they get in return they believe to be efficiently and fairly delivered. These are small, homogeneous countries with high social trust, which their experts are first to remind you the U.S. isn't. Wisdom in the old is an aspiration, not a given. A reference for our time is Judge Richard Posner's 1995 book, Aging and Old Age, with its frank discussion of the relationship between shortened time horizons in the elderly and unchecked selfishness. A more reliable source than Mr. Sanders is the platform of the Democratic Socialist of America. It plainly sees that dismantling America's constitutional checks and balances is a precondition for enacting its policy preferences. The news isn't all bad. Even as some of America's young voters are lapping up Mandani, others are inventing artificial intelligence. Its promise may all but require overhauling the social contract, finding new co-Asian insights in how to divide the public and private sectors. The communist dream of the last century held out hope of an interesting, creative life for all, uncompelled by need or deference to others. AI may actually deliver such a future someday. Meanwhile, there's an answer for young socialists seeking relief from having to be self-directing and self-supporting. For them, there's the army. They'll always know where their next meal is coming from and what to wear. Their time will be structured, accommodations provided. The geopolitical outlook suggests their services will be much in demand in the years ahead. Of course, the U.S. military system, among the world's military systems, is one that also prizes initiative. A lesson for socialists: you can't have everything. El Sayed abandons the middle. Republican Mike Rogers has a chance to win Democratic votes in Michigan. By William McGurn. The election is coming. The election is coming. Just as Paul Revere warned colonists about the approach of the British, Mike Rogers is trying to rouse Michiganders to action by saying the election begins not in November, but on September 24th, when early voting begins. Election day is November 3rd, just under 6 weeks later. Mr. Rogers, the Republican candidate for Senate, is squaring off against Democrat Abdu El Sayed, a 41-year-old Rhodes Scholar and doctor who never practiced medicine. This tight race will determine not only who Michigan sends to Washington, but possibly who controls the Senate. One August poll shows Mr. El Sayed with an edge, though others show Mr. Rogers ahead. This is a battle between common sense ideas and radical extremist policies peddled by a con man that are out of place in our society, Mr. Rogers says. Mr. Rogers hopes his conservative record and moderate demeanor attract not only Republicans but disaffected Democrats too. Mr. El Sayed won his primary by 1 point, and a majority of Democrats voted against him. Mr. Rogers' background should help. He is a former Army lieutenant who joined the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He then entered Michigan politics, serving 2 terms as a state senator and 7 terms in the House, where he rose to become Intelligence Committee chairman. In 2024, when Mr. Rogers ran for Michigan's other Senate seat, he lost by only 19,000 votes, or less than half a percentage point. This time, the GOP has its usual issues, mostly involving President Trump. But if Mr. Rogers can hold on to his base while attracting Democrats who think their party has gone too left, he will prevail. Already the Muslim card is being played for and against Mr. El Sayed. This weekend, the Washington Post carried this headline: El Sayed's win triggered wave of anti-Muslim rhetoric online, Post analysis shows. The subhead explained that after Mr. El Sayed became the Democratic nominee, conservative commentary about him shifted focus from socialism to his Muslim identity. In Michigan, home to about 240,000 Muslims, these are fighting words. Thus, the effort to cast Mr. Rogers as a bigot. Earlier in the month, Mr. Rogers released a video of himself tooling around Michigan in a cherry red vintage Ford pickup truck. A staffer for the El Sayed campaign said on X, "Mike Rogers' campaign has the aesthetics of a 1960s white flight suburb and a KKK cross burning." Nolan Finley, a columnist for the Detroit News, likens the crack to Hillary Clinton's dismissing Trump voters as a basket of deplorables. Mr. Finley points out that the Ford F-150, which debuted in 1975, is the nation's best-selling truck line and is a symbol of working America, making the staffer's comment not a smart thing to say in Motor City. Mr. Finley's larger point is that Mr. El Sayed isn't even trying to appeal to the middle. Ask Eric Bronstein, a businessman who is circulating a letter by Michigan Jews Against Extremism. Many of us have been fiercely supportive of Democratic candidates and principles, it reads. All of us have felt threatened and alienated by the politics and allies embraced by Abdul El Sayed, which has included demonization of Jews, equivocation on terrorism, exclusion of Jewish Americans from public life, and expression of implacable hatred of the world's only Jewish nation. Mr. Rogers is trying to take advantage of the situation with a special effort to court Jewish voters. He's firmly pro-Israel, but he's also said the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee should stay out of the race. AIPAC spends $32 million in the Democratic primary in an unsuccessful effort to defeat Mr. El Sayed, and that has become an issue. Mr. El Sayed has denounced AIPAC and Israel, but he also claims he wants only equal rights for Muslims. He says his commitment to Jewish safety is the same commitment that I have to the safety of my own daughters. But Mr. El Sayed calls Israel bloodthirsty, accuses it of apartheid and genocide, and likens American attempts to banish Sharia or Islamic law to white supremacy. Where Mr. El Sayed is doubling down, Mr. Rogers is reaching out. Time is money in Michigan, and early votes are money in the bank, he says. People forget or get busy, or a sudden trip pops up. There's bad weather on election day. I need my voters to defeat Abdul by putting the vote in the bank as soon as the polls open in September. The Pepper and Salt cartoon today shows a couple seated with their backs toward us, and in the middle is a man dressed like a sports referee. And that man says, "Oh, this is just my marriage counseling uniform." You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 26th issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening, and hopefully have a wonderful day or evening.